Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, our reporter in Manila describes the devastation from Typhoon Kopu. An analyst says the Israeli-Palestinian crisis has been overtaken by other issues. We speak with an author about a new report on children and inequality.
One of the surprising things in the report, though, was just how far these disadvantages spread into other elements of well-being.
And hear about a new movie possibly inspiring tomorrow's space travelers. It's right here on The Voice of America. At least two people have been confirmed dead and tens of thousands more displaced as slow-moving Typhoon Kopu washed over the northern Philippines. Reporter Simone Orendain is in Manila and is on the line with us now. Simone, what can you tell us about this storm?
Well, it is slow moving. The State Bureau has said that it's just crawling along at 5 kilometers per hour, which means that it's just dumping lots of rain. It's got a cloud span of 600 kilometers, and so there's rain falling everywhere. And as it's moving towards the west, the State Bureau also says that it's expected to have rainfall that's equivalent to half a month within a 24-hour period. So they're expecting just some very serious flooding, and they're greatly concerned about this. So far, what it's left in its path has been inundated rice fields. There have been reports of farmers who've said they just lost 2 months' worth of crops. People on their rooftops trying to just get away from all of this water, which is it's muddy water coming down from the mountain. It hit a mountainous area first. It made landfall right by the Sierra Madre mountain chain on the east coast. And because the mountain was up there and there was a high-pressure area to the west, combined with another typhoon behind it on the east, it just remained stationary there and was moving even slower than 5 kilometers at that point. This was on Sunday. And so it just kept dumping and dumping rains and caused landslides that have, at least in 4 locations that we know of, according to the Civil Defense Office, blocked off towns.
Tell us about in the cities, power lines down, that sort of thing?
Yeah, it knocked out power lines. At one point, something like close to 80 municipalities and cities were without power, but then some of it's been restored, and about 24 are still without power. Apparently, some communications lines were also knocked down in 2 places or maybe 3 in several towns. There's been a lot of debris that the military is trying to clean and clear up. Close to 50 roads and bridges have been blocked off by landslides, flooding, debris, and trees.
What about the response, the emergency response?
Well, like I said, the military is out there cleaning up. There have been some rescue efforts. The Philippine Red Cross volunteers have gone out to those flooded areas, especially by the mountains, because places where, like the Pampanga River is like in central Luzon Island. This typhoon is hanging over Luzon Island, which is the Philippines' main island. And some rescue workers are by that river, which just completely overflowed. And so the water that's moving through these towns is like currents. So there's rescue workers who are pulling people out. You know, they're on these lifelines, on these ropes being pulled up and in. So the Philippine Red Cross is doing that. The military and police are doing that. And also in other parts where there's flooding, they've been rescuing people.
Well, what about the government? What have they done about all this?
Well, they've been doing a lot of preemptive evacuations and sending warnings out. You know, they've been doing a lot of predictions with the weather and trickling down from national government to provincial to regional to cities and municipalities. A message that they just need to get people evacuated. And so the government has set up food package stations where there's pre-packed food and stuff, supplies that are ready to be given at shelters and at the shelters that they are sending people to. Government is also getting messages out. I mean, they've been just really getting messages out mostly is what they're doing, just warnings and coordinating with the provincial governments who are then getting the rescue people in, going out and doing the cleanup, you know, getting people to do those other operations that I talked about.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
You're welcome.
Now with today's social media report is Olin Akisholu. Welcome, Olin.
Thank you, Susan. Well, photos in particular are getting a lot of attention. There are quite a few going around that show people in the Philippines exposed and during the typhoon, even some walking around in flooded streets barefoot. So despite some of the reported power failure and communications problems, there are still photos and videos coming out of the region and making it onto social media. The top post for Typhoon Kopu on Facebook came from NASA's Hurricane webpage yesterday. That was a photo from its Terra Modus satellite showing the typhoon above the Philippines that tracked its movement so far and estimated wind speeds around 78 miles per hour. A later post from NASA upgraded the maximum wind speeds to 120 miles per hour and reported 37-foot high seas. A lot of storm updates are being shared and also information about where to go for aid. National Disaster Risk Reduction and Management Council tweeted out an infographic that had a list of hotlines for the country's Department of Health, Coast Guard, National Red Cross, and some other programs. That was shared close to 200 times. And of course, there are a lot of people expressing their sympathy for the Philippines, offering their prayers for the region while it deals with all of the flooding.
What else is going on around social media today?
Well, another top trend on Facebook right now is the comedian John Oliver. And he's trending because yesterday on his show, Last Week Tonight, he got a little involved in Canadian politics. Canada's prime ministerial election is today, so he brought on Canadian actor Mike Myers and urged voters not to vote for the incumbent Stephen Harper. And there was kind of a mixed reaction from people on social media. A lot are saying they didn't like Harper anyway, and they're ready for a new prime minister after 10 years. But some people were also saying that they don't really like the idea of American television personalities getting involved in Canadian politics.
Okay, well, thank you, Olin.
Thanks.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Scientists have created two new maps of Jupiter with data and images gathered by the Hubble Space Telescope's High Performance Wide Field Camera 3. The maps are a representation of two nearly continuous rotations of the solar system's largest planet. The new maps revealed some interesting new features on Jupiter. Among them is an odd wave that was observed just north of Jupiter's equator in an area flecked with storms. Another is an odd and delicate streamer-like feature that was spotted for the first time at the heart of the Great Red Spot, a giant storm spinning counterclockwise in the planet's southern hemisphere. Along with Jupiter, new maps will also be created annually of Saturn, Neptune, and Uranus. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The United States is showing its increasing concern over the violence in Israel. My colleague Victor Beatty is following that story and has joined us here in the studio. Victor.
Well, hello, Susan. Even as violence between Israelis and Palestinians deepened on Sunday, the top U.S. military officer, Marine General Joseph Dunford, was in Israel Sunday, resuming talks on deepening defense ties despite disagreements over the Iran nuclear agreement. Israel was Dunford's first foreign stop since assuming the post of chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff October 1st. At the same time, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is planning to meet separately this week with Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas on the latest violence, which has left at least 8 Israelis and more than 40 Palestinians dead in clashes over the past month. Regional analyst Jonathan Edelman of the University of Denver told me the long-running conflict has been overtaken by other regional security issues.
On both sides, there was hope that someday they would eventually get a compromise that each side could live with. And I think the world has just pretty much forgotten this. But I think it's a failure of leadership, and it starts on the Palestinian side, of course, with Abu Mazen, who's almost 80 and wants to retire to his house in Amman, Jordan. And on the Israeli side, the feeling that they're isolated after losing out on the Iran deal. Neither side is really interested right now in compromising.
Secretary of State John Kerry is to meet both Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and Palestinian leader Abbas in separate meetings. What might those conversations entail, in your view?
I don't think John Kerry is going to get far. He went many, many times, as you remember, over the last few years, trying to negotiate between the two. But the irony is that doesn't work. If you really think about it, the only times that this has worked, whether it was the Rhodes Agreement in 1949 or it was the Oslo I and Oslo II agreements, when the two sides really want to do this and they go out and they do it by themselves. Oslo was remarkable because they went to Norway and they held secret agreements on what they were going to do. I think it's nice that John Kerry is going there, but I think he actually can accomplish very little. I mean, the real issue in the Middle East today, of course, is not the Arab-Israeli conflict anymore. The real issue has to do with ISIS, it has to do with al-Nusra, it has to do with al-Qaeda, it has to do with Iran, and so this has now been kind of shoved to the side. That's the reality, and with Russia going into Syria, that's just further accelerated the trend that this is kind of an irrelevant issue, something we don't need to worry about right now.
Well, the top U.S. general, the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Marine General Joseph Dunford, happens to be in Tel Aviv. Apparently, there are reports that Israel and the U.S. are bolstering their security ties and say those ties are back on track despite dispute over the Iran nuclear deal.
That's very good. It moves in a different direction. But I think it's important because Israel has been the biggest ally for the United States, certainly militarily. In the Middle East, there's almost $1 billion worth of American military equipment there for future conflicts. Bibi Netanyahu made up his mind that he definitely was going to try to improve what had become very poor relations between Israel and the United States. And I think the Americans did the same. But Netanyahu did something else that didn't get a lot of attention, which is he's also seriously improving his relations with Russia, which is the same thing that Saudi Arabia is doing and that Egypt is doing. In fact, they're going to go from Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and elsewhere to a conference in Moscow later this year, and Netanyahu went off to Moscow to have a discussion with Putin. So I think that's something also we need to pay attention to, because it means, well, the Americans are busy with this semi-withdrawal and we're not going to get involved in any more fighting. The Russians are going in, well, maybe with not too much enthusiasm, but to show that they're a reliable ally, they're not going to withdraw from the conflicts in the Middle East.
Sunday, an Israeli soldier was killed. At least 10 other Israelis were wounded following a shooting rampage by a Palestinian man at the central bus station in the city of Beersheba. The gunman was shot and killed. The latest wave of violence was sparked by rumors that swept through the Palestinian areas that Israel was planning to take over an East Jerusalem holy site sacred to both Muslims and Jews. Israel has repeatedly denied any such plans.
Thank you, Victor.
All right, Susan.
Coming up on International Edition, poverty hurting kids more than we may think, and learning to survive on Mars.
Children are paying a high price for inequality in the world, according to a new report from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. OECD spokesperson and co-author of the report, Carrie Exton, joins us on the line. Welcome, Carrie.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Oh, thank you. What in general did the report find?
So there are a number of different elements covered in the report, but one of the things that we focused on for the first time this year was well-being among children. And there are some quite remarkable results. Even within OECD countries, and we're talking about 34 of the wealthiest countries in the world, we find that child poverty, for example, 1 in 7 children are living in income poverty. 1 in 10 children in OECD households are living in homes where no one works. So even among the most affluent countries, we're seeing high levels of children not getting a good start in life.
Other than the obvious reason of money, how do advantage and disadvantage children differ in their lives?
So this was actually one of the surprising results, because obviously you would expect that among more disadvantaged groups, the material living conditions are worse, so the housing conditions might be worse, the levels of poverty might be worse. One of the surprising things in the report, though, was just how far these disadvantages spread into other elements of well-being. So if we look at, for example, some of the child health outcomes, among children from the most affluent families, only 11% of children report being in poor health. When we look at the poorer families, that rises up to 18% of children. Similarly, we have much higher rates of obesity among less affluent families. And we also see that relationships, both with peers and parents, tend to be worse among the less affluent children.
And you're talking about things that don't change. This could affect their entire lives.
This indeed is one of the reasons why it's so worrying, because we're seeing this transmission over the generations of disadvantage, and it's really something that we need to break that cycle.
Well, how do we go about doing that?
I think one of the important things about this report is that it's telling us when we think about children in disadvantage, we need to think beyond just the material conditions in which they're living. So children living in households with lower income, the parents might need a lot of support in a lot of different areas of their lives.
What about volunteering and that sort of thing, something that an average person could do?
Volunteering is another feature in this report. It's the first time that we've tried to collect comparative data across a wide variety of different countries on volunteering. And indeed, it's absolutely one of the findings that we report is that volunteering essentially offers win-wins for well-being. So we see that volunteering has advantages for communities, but it also actually is beneficial to the volunteers themselves. They tend to have higher well-being than non-volunteers.
So this report is really a signpost for folks to know that this needs to change.
Yes. I mean, one of the sort of unique features of this report is the variety of dimensions of life that we cover. We're really going much beyond GDP to try and understand ways in which life could get better for ordinary people.
And the name of the report, so folks can go online and find out about it?
It's called How's Life 2015.
Okay. Thank you so much for talking with us today, Carrie.
Thank you very much.
This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Martian is a film about a marooned astronaut who uses science, wit, and courage to survive in a very hostile environment. The movie is making hundreds of millions of dollars and has gotten some very good reviews. Some scientists also are saying the film from the 20th Century Fox has the potential to inspire as well as entertain. VOA's Michael Lippin has the story.
In The Martian, Mark Watney is a U.S. astronaut who has to survive alone on Mars after his crew leaves the planet without him, thinking he died in a storm that swept him away.
Luckily, I'm a botanist.
The botanist, played by Matt Damon, is not a typical Hollywood hero, but he is one of several role models in the film for aspiring scientists.
Begin abort procedure.
Another is Mars Mission Commander Melissa Lewis, played by Jessica Chastain. It's a performance that excites Costa Rican space enthusiast and student Montserrat Cordero, who appeared on hashtag VOA via Skype.
Jessica Chastain's character is amazing. We also have the computer programmer, who's also a woman. Like, this is not what we tend to see, so really excited to see this kind of thing. Hope to see a lot more of it.
Cordero is a graduate of an international summer school run by the Foundation for International Space Education in Houston, Texas. Its director of educational programs told hashtag VOA via Skype that the Martians' role models will have a positive influence.
The more women we have involved in science, technology, and engineering and math, the better society we have, and the better we'll be able to accomplish those missions and do things like go to Mars.
In the film, U.S. government space agency NASA tries to overcome great obstacles to bring Watney back to Earth. That's not just science fiction. The science and technology you see in the movie is based on real-life work by NASA, which acted as an advisor to the filmmakers. And the work being done here at NASA headquarters in Washington includes preparations for an actual manned mission to Mars. As part of that effort, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory has been operating rovers to collect Martian soil samples. Speaking to hashtag VOA via Skype, the laboratory's Mars engineering manager says his team needs diversity to succeed.
People from who see the world from different angles to come in and bring their creative ideas with them to come here and to help us out. So, you know, this, what we do here is really, in many respects, an international effort.
NASA hopes The Martian will help that effort by inspiring young scientists everywhere to bring humans to Mars by the 2030s.
I've done the math. Checks out.
Michael Lippin, VOA News, Washington.
Rich. Yes, sir.
Get out.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The world's ocean is the Earth's greatest resource. It produces much of our oxygen, regulates our climate, and supports the greatest abundance of life on our planet. All life is inextricably tied to it, so if the ocean were to disappear today, nearly every creature, every plant would soon follow. Nonetheless, we humans have not been the best caretakers of our ocean, wrote Undersecretary for Economic Growth, Energy, and the Environment, Catherine Novelli, in a recent article. The world's fish stocks are depleted and continue to be overfished. Plastic debris is choking our waters, and the carbon we are pumping into the air is increasing water acidity. So we are doing something about it. The health of our ocean was part of the Sustainable Development Summit at the recently held 70th session of the UN General Assembly. Members adopted the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development, a blueprint that will guide global development over the next 15 years. In doing so, they pledged to work toward conservation and sustainable use of the ocean and marine resources. Following on the heels of the UN conference is our Ocean Conference, which recently took place in Santiago, Chile. 500 representatives of governments, academia, the private sector, and civil society worked to find solutions to overfishing, plastic pollution, and ocean acidification. They are continuing the work begun at the first Our Ocean Conference, which took place in Washington last year. At the time, participants from 90 countries announced new partnerships and initiatives and committed to promote sustainable fisheries, reduce pollution, monitor and prevent acidification, and pledge to protect over 3 million square kilometers of the ocean. There is a growing understanding that a healthy and resilient ocean will help drive widespread and shared prosperity, including economic, food, energy security, and will ensure the health of our planet for generations to come, said Undersecretary Novelli. The United States and its partners around the world have been working together to tackle challenges such as ocean acidification, unsustainable fishing, and marine debris. And we've made a lot of progress, and so our momentum going forward is only going stronger.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.